Okay, there we go. There's quite a few people outside. Can I ask when you come in here actually to move closer to the front, because that gives more opportunity for those in the back to actually find a nice place, because lots of room in the front. And monks, we do have showers, so we don't smell. You can come much closer. In fact, the closer you get, the more energy you can feel. I learned from our young president that the people in the front, it's called like the mosh pit. Is that right? So these are the people in the mosh pit at the front. Moshies. Okay, it's been a couple of weeks since I've been giving a talk here, because last week was Sister Wayama's opportunity, the week before Ajahn Yanadamo's. But I still always get these requests over the fax machine, letters or emails to give talks on certain subjects. And the request which I've got this evening is to give a talk on loneliness. And again, I love being able to give talks on such subjects and be able to weave the ideas of Buddhism and of meditation around these themes to really allow people to understand not only just what Buddhism is and what meditation teaches, but also how it applies to some problems which we face from time to time in the world. Because loneliness is a problem for many people. For some people it's a chronic problem. A problem of loneliness which creates an enormous amount of suffering, angst, even suicide in their lives. And I think for everybody there will become a time when you're by yourself and you may fall prey to that sickness we call loneliness. So I'm going to talk about loneliness tonight, what it actually is, why it's a problem, and obviously how we can actually surmount that problem to transcend it and even be able to celebrate and enjoy loneliness. And I suppose that as a monk I am quite qualified to talk about loneliness, because being a monk you spend a lot of time in solitude. And spending time in solitude, you are alone. But it's very different than the feelings of loneliness. Nevertheless, I can recall as a young monk, or even earlier as a young person, an understanding actually what loneliness was, and understand why there was such a loneliness and how to actually overcome it. So to start off with, I always like to start off with a story, and I can't help but telling a joke to begin with. So this is this evening's joke about loneliness. I was trying to find what's an appropriate joke in my repertoire of used and well-worn jokes, but something which is topical as well. There's these three men who were victims of the tsunami. They were washed away. But fortunately, they managed to survive by being washed up on a desert island. There was the American, the English man, and the Australian man. Now, I know I was born in England, but I've been in Australia for a long time now. So but anyway, it was 3 or 4 months, and people had stopped searching for tsunami survivors, so they were in big trouble on this desert island. There was plenty to eat and lots to drink, but they were getting terribly lonely. And one day, a bottle washed up on the beach. And of course, if you're in such a situation and you've read other people's jokes, you know you should rub that bottle, because there might be a genie in it. And it was a genie, otherwise there would be no joke. And the genie came out, and according to tradition, which is well known in all religions, the genies can only give you three wishes. And so the genie said, "There's three obvious, so that's one wish each. What would it be?" And of course the American said, "I wish I was back in New York, in a diner having a proper meal for a change." And straight away, as soon as he made that wish, it was granted. He disappeared from the island, and he was in a diner in New York having a nice big hamburger. Oh, he was just so happy. And they asked the Englishman, said, "What was your wish?" And he said, "Oh, I wish I was in a pub, a nice English pub in front of a pint of beer." And as soon as he made that wish, it was granted. There he was in the nice one of his old country pubs in England, in front of a nice warm pint of beer. Oh, he was in heaven. And they asked the Australian, what do you want? And he said, well, maybe I should be at the footy match. Or no, maybe I should be at the Buddhist Society on a Friday night. And he said, I can't make up my mind. I wish my two friends were back here to help me decide. I'm surprised you haven't heard that joke before. Now we're getting serious about loneliness. Because it happens to us from time to time that people are lonely, but that sometimes there's the first aspect of loneliness. It is that sometimes there's like all states of mind, all states of life. They always have the positive and the negative to it. And part of our problem when facing the difficulties in life is, again, always look at the negative part of it and not actually seeing the benefits of loneliness, or like aloneness rather. Because it's wonderful being alone. You know, you don't have to sort of, you can decide what TV program you want to watch without arguing with somebody else. You can decide what to eat. You can decide what you want to do and when you want to do it. There's an incredible amount of freedom being by yourself. But there's some dangers or some non-benefits, suffering about being by yourself, not having someone to talk to share moments with. There's also some bad side of being by oneself. And this particular aspect of the good side and the bad side of all situations was really brought to mind in one of the classic stories, which I bring up every now and again. I'm not sure when the last time it was I brought this up, but it was a classic case when some years ago two Thai ladies, they came to see me, and they were sisters. And you know, they came after our meal to actually ask their questions, and they had problems. They wanted to see a monk to try and find some solution for their problems. There were different problems. Because the first one, her problem was her husband. She was married. She'd been married for a long time and had some marital problems. In fact, she couldn't stand her husband. And she wanted to know, should I get divorced, or should I sort of get some advice and try and work through these problems? But, you know, she was tending towards divorce. And I was telling her, look, you know, just see the nice part of your husband. He's not all bad. You know, when you get married, you see the beautiful side of your husband. You get in denial about his faults. And when you want to get divorced, you get in denial about his good parts, the things why you married him. He's just a husband, that's all. So I talked to him about trying to sort of get him to see the nice side of her husband. Actually, there's this story. I'm just going off on a tangent now. This is a wonderful story which I was told in Singapore some years ago about a very, very skillful marriage counselor. Because he had a similar problem. A client came to her and said, now, I've been married for many, many years now, but my husband doesn't show any interest in me anymore. In fact, he comes home late from the office. I don't know for sure, but you know, I think he might be having an affair with another woman. And I said, I want to get divorced from him. And the marriage counselor was very smart. He said, look, you know, he probably wants you to get divorced from him. And so if you get divorced from him, you're doing exactly what he wants. He'd be very happy. He said, yeah. He said, now, this is what you should do. You want to get his own back. Don't get divorced yet. What you should do is actually try and find a nice, do a bit of a facelift, get a nice hairstyle, get some really nice clothes. Because after a while, see if you can actually get him to fall in love with you again. It may take a while, but you know, it can be done. Be really nice to him, really tender, really kind. Do all the nice things which you know you think he likes. And the plan is that when he starts to like you again, and especially when he starts to get in love with you again, then divorce him. I said, yeah! So that was the plan. If you divorce him when he wants you to get divorced, then that's, you know, that's just doing what he wants. So she got a really nice outfit, did herself up, was really kind to him and very, very pleasant. And every week or two, the marriage counsel would actually have a visit and say, what's going on? How's it going? He said, actually, it's working because he's coming home earlier. He said, great, keep it up. And every 2 weeks he started coming home earlier, being a more kind to her, a bit more tender, a bit more more loving. It was working. And then it came to a point where she didn't turn up for her counselling sessions for about a month. And so the counsellor called her at home and said, "What's going on? You haven't called. You know, is he sort of becoming kinder to you?" He said, "Oh, yeah." "And he's becoming more sort of tender, more loving?" "Oh, yeah." He said, "Is he falling in love with you?" He said, "Yes, he has fallen in love with me." And the counsellor said, "Great, now's the time to divorce him." "Oh, no, he's so nice." And that was a big plan in the long run, actually, to get to get that man sort of back in line by being kind to them. But anyhow, if that doesn't work for your marriage, this lady had another solution for her marriage, because she was telling about the problems with her husband. And so, you know, when I sort of figured there was no sort of solution there, I started talking to her sister. "So what's your problem?" And her problem, that she was single. She couldn't find a partner. And when I suggested the obvious solution, they weren't interested. It's obvious. You've got a husband you don't want. She wants a husband. Swap. It's logical. But the deepest part of that story was that, and I told them afterwards, I talked to the wife. I said, "You've got what we call like wife suffering, relationship suffering. And you think if you can get rid of that husband, that you'll have no suffering anymore. But if you get rid of your husband, you'll have the suffering which your sister has, which you call single person suffering. It's a completely different type of suffering, but you've got rid of the relationship suffering, now you've got single person suffering. And you who are single, if you go and find a nice partner, you won't have your single person suffering anymore. You will have married person suffering." So what you're really doing is just changing one type of suffering for another. And this is actually with loneliness or aloneness. Sometimes we look at aloneness, being by ourselves. Sure, there's a lot of suffering which is there being by alone, being by yourself. But if you get another partner or a friend or someone else to be with you, it's not that the problem disappears. It just changes its shape and changes its form. Instead of having lonely suffering, you have being with others suffering instead. So know that, and know that with all situations in our life, there's never any perfection there in the sense that it's always happiness, always wonderful. You're just changing one particular type of problem for another problem. The problem of loneliness is changed to being a problem, being in society, being with others, of socializing. And I think that we should all remember that. Because then, instead of thinking that this is a problem, everything will be okay once I find a friend, a partner, once I could join a club, that's not true. Other problems come in their stead. So because of that, that people say, "Well, what's the point? Okay, I'm by myself, now I'm with other people, now I'm by myself again. Is there some sort of way out of all this?" And of course there is a way out of this. We're always changing our situations and think that once I change my situation, once I change my job, once I change my partner, you know, once I'm by myself, or once I'm with others, once my kids grow up, once I become a monk, once I stop being a monk, once I do go here, once I stop doing that, we think that that's going to make us happiness. No. The point of life, the wisdom which comes from us, is actually if we're by ourselves, instead of seeing the problem of being by ourselves, see its beauty, see its benefits, see the appreciation of being by oneself. And if one is with others, stop looking at the problems of being with others, to see its beauty, its wonder of being able to share one's tie with another person. So it's changing from the negative attitude, thinking, "Oh, this is terrible, this is wrong," and change it to a positive. It's what I call like the relationships we have with the moments of our life. It's not the moments themselves which is the problem. It's not our situation, our circumstances which is the problem. It is how we relate to it. It's not just being alone which is a problem. It's how we relate to being alone. That is the problem. It's not being married which is the problem. It's how we relate to being married which is the problem. It's not just sitting up here and talking to, 300, 400 people here, and you know, maybe over 1,000 on the internet. That's not the problem. It's how we relate to that. That's the problem. So it is a relationship problem. But a relationship in the deepest sense of the term, actually how we relate to what we're experiencing. And in our practice of Buddhism, in our practice of meditation, in our practice of things, the thing in itself is never the problem, it's how we look at it. That is the problem. Someone was asking me to also include in this talk the fact that there's a new pope, a Catholic pope now, and talking about sin. I mean, what actually is sin? How can we relate to sort of a new pope? Or how can we relate to another religion? It's never the religion which is the problem. It's the relationship that is the problem. So how we relate to these things, how we relate to that person, how we relate to the things of our life. And I mention that because we had a wonderful afternoon yesterday having the 9 of the monks from the Benedictine monastery in New Norcia who came to our monastery down at Serpentine, as they do once a year, for an afternoon of discussion about spirituality. And this was a special occasion because SBS were there as well. And they were doing a documentary on this very wonderful exchange which we have. And of course, just after 1 or 2 minutes, we forgot the camera was there. And we're having this wonderful exchange from the Benedictine monastic perspective and the Buddhist monastic perspective. And we went on for about 2 or 3 hours. Really sort of some deep discussion about the nature of God or the transcendent and just how we relate to those things. And it was always, yeah, I agree with that. Yeah, Albert Platt said, I agree with you. And the people who are actually doing the documentary, the reporter and also the cameraman, were amazed, astounded. And afterwards they said it was only supposed to get a few minutes for part of a documentary, but there's a whole documentary in what they filmed yesterday. Just actually to see just how two different religions can relate together so well. And even though they're two different truths, how we can relate them together and build up something which we have in common. It's not the fact if you're a Christian or you're a Buddhist or you're a girl or you're a boy or you're Sri Lankan or you're Australian or whatever. It's how we relate to that. That is where we put sort of the effort in our life. It's not that Christianity is the truth, and this is one of the problems with that pope. If he goes that path, he's going to create a lot of problems. It's not that Buddhism is the truth. The truth lies in the relationship between the Buddhists and the Christians. That's where the truth lies. And if that relationship is anger, war, I don't want, controlling, domination, or even just trying to destroy, when we know that relationship is not truth. But if it's a one of listening, respecting, discussing, love, peace, then that relationship, that's what you know as truth. Which is why I always say that when the Muslim Taliban destroyed those big Buddha statues in Bamiyan, they can't destroy Buddhism that way. How they could have destroyed Buddhism is if the Buddhists got angry and wanted revenge. You destroyed our Buddhas, we're going to destroy your mosques. Then they would have destroyed Buddhism, which is the relationship which we have with the events which happen in our life. So someone hurts us, they destroy our possessions. How do we relate to that? Are we really creating this peace, this understanding, this positive way of saying, what can we do with this so we don't create more destruction, but we create more peace, more harmony? We go forward rather than backwards in life. So when it comes to something like loneliness, there you're alone. That's not going to destroy your happiness. It's the relationship you have to being alone. That can destroy your happiness if you allow it. So we look at being alone. Why is it a problem? Can't we just enjoy being by ourselves? I love being by myself, but I also love being with you guys. And sometimes I live a very, very strange life. I live a life of extremes. Because many of you know, 2 or 3 years ago, that I spent 6 months in absolute solitude, where I never even saw another human being for 6 months, let alone talk to them. I saw a few kangaroos and snakes and all these other little animals, but not human beings. And that's for 6 months. And it was only a few weeks ago when I was in Colombo. That's why I was giving a talk in the middle of this crowd of 10,000. Now that's extremes. One moment, sort of 10,000 people are looking at you, and a few years before, no one even knew I was there. Completely disappeared. Now, in this both situations, it wasn't 6 months of solitude which was a problem or difficulty at all. It's how I related to that. That which was between me and that experience. It's the same when you're talking to 10,000 people. It's what's between you and those people. That's what you focused on. When you actually look what's between us, here we let go of this sense of self and them. Me and you. Or when you're by yourself, it's me and nobody. This is that what's in between is where the problems lie. So it didn't really matter what I was experiencing. It always became a matter of how I'm experiencing that. What am I doing about it? How am I relating to this? And when you understand that's the reason why we can get into suffering, or that's the reason why we can get free of suffering, so many opportunities come into place of how to deal with those many occasions in your life where no one else is going to be around. When I say with places where no one else can be around, sometimes you may be sitting here in this hall of 300, 400 people, but still feel very alone. Still be inside of yourself and relating to this experience as being alone. Sometimes, as you know, loneliness is in a whole crowd of people. Sometimes you feel that. Sometimes loneliness, it can be just in your own room or in your own home when no one else is around. That can be there as well. So sometimes you can't detect loneliness. People can be with others, but still be very, very lonely. Which is why it does happen, and it's such a tragedy when you do find people committing suicide and they are so lonely. And you wonder why. We've got a family, we talk together, we meet together, we go out together, but they are lonely. It's how they're relating to those times in their life when no one else is around. And they are the majority of your time in this world. This was one of the sayings, I think, of the Buddha, but certainly I remember my teacher Ajahn Chah used to say this a lot. He said, "You're born alone. You die alone. And much of the time you spend in between is alone." I remember that saying because one of my friends, who was the abbot of the monastery in New Zealand, he told me he went back to his mother in Canada, and when he was talking about Buddhism to her, he said, "I was born alone. I would die alone." And I said, "No, you weren't. I was there." Said his mother. And that was the end of trying to convert his mother to being a Buddhist. It's one thing I found out, I tell all the other monks, that you cannot teach your mother anything. She's taught you ever since you were small. So, even if I gave up on my mother a long time ago, other monks can teach my mother, but I can't, no way. But anyhow, back to being like alone. It is, and there's a lot of truth there, because when you wake up in the morning, you're alone. There you are again. And you have your thoughts, feeling your body. Even it may be your wife, your husband next to you, you still wake up alone. And so this is where we can actually learn how we're relating to that feeling there, that being there, and being by oneself. And I've been training myself for many, many years, and I just do it automatically now. When I wake up in the morning, what my first thought usually is? Good morning, me. Nice to see you again. And it's great to be able to have that friendliness to this first moment when you wake up. And what's the last thing I do before I go to sleep at night? Good night, have a nice sleep, me. Now you may think that's a joke, but I do that. And it makes a lot of difference to your life. It's a simple thing. And sometimes the simple things, you know, we think don't really count very much. They're not valuable. We want some other sort of great technique to be able to sort of get in a sense of in touch with ourselves and friendliness to ourselves to overcome this loneliness. But no, that really works. Because it starts the day off with this beautiful feeling of friendliness towards yourself. You're relating in a positive way, just by the feeling of good morning. Sometimes I have great fun as a monk, especially in the early years, or whenever I go to places where they don't really know monks very much. It's not so much fun now in Perth because people got to know who you are and they recognize you as monks. But when you first came here, or for example, when I went to see my mother in England for the first time, and you're walking down the streets of London, you know what English people are like. It's not just a stiff upper lip, the whole of them is stiff. And so I was going down these streets. Every person I met, no matter who they were, saying, good morning, good morning. And I know English psychology, if someone says good morning to you, you have to say good morning back. Even if you don't feel like doing it, and it's some weirdo in a brown robe who's saying it to you. It was psychological pressure. And I put all this psychological pressure on all these people with a big smile, good morning. And I said, oh, good morning. It was great fun making people do this. It's great fun being a monk. Because as soon as they see someone weird, they want to go along the other side of the road. I don't know if you're going to convert them or you're going to attack them or something. One of the best times, though, was when I was in the Midlands of England. Because my mother used to come from Stoke-on-Trent. And so I had some relations in the Midlands. And I went to go and see them. Because when you go there, you've got to see this relation and that relation. It takes a long time. But anyway, in the morning, I want to walk, have a bit of exercise. So I was walking along the streets of Stoke-on-Trent and all these people were pointing at me and laughing. It was only afterwards I found out there was a circus in town and they thought I was one of the clowns. I thought, what a wonderful thing. I don't mind that, making people laugh. So I never got upset. I thought, what a wonderful opportunity. What a great privilege to create some laughter in Stoke-on-Trent on a sort of a November sort of cold morning. So when you don't worry what people think of you, you never get upset when people laugh. Remember that one great saying which I've said here before? It's actually in my little book. If anybody laughs because, you know, of your appearance or what you said, always make sure you laugh as well. Because then the world or any person can never laugh at you. They can only laugh with you. It's a beautiful saying. So when you do something absolutely stupid and ridiculous, you make an idiot of yourself, you laugh. You laugh as well. Then the whole world laughs with you, never laugh at you. And so this old ego and this loneliness, this self-business starts to disappear. And this is actually where I wanted to lead this talk into. One of the reasons why people get afraid of loneliness is because of this self-business which we have. Because we have this thing called an identity. And it's very often loneliness is an identity crisis. When we're by ourselves, we don't know who we are and what we're supposed to do and how we relate to life in itself. Too often we have these stereotypes that you're supposed to have friends, you're supposed to be married, you're supposed to have kids, or you're supposed to have somebody there. And being alone, we have the identity crisis. Not only feeling like a failure, we're no good, we're hopeless, we're useless, but also we have the not knowing how we fit into things in the world. This having an identity, fitting in, being sort of someone who is somebody in this world, is such a strong demand of an ego, of a self, that it becomes, you know, we're always playing roles, we're always trying to fit in, doing things. I remember just sometimes as a young man when I used to go and watch soccer in London, just how you felt you were somebody when you actually joined in that crowd of maniacs shouting for a soccer team. Or how the people, if they go over to one of these Western derbies in Fremantle versus the Eagles, why people enjoy that, because now they've got an identity. They're an Eagle supporter, they're a Docker supporter. And when we make these identities, these little selves which we have, They are like not just cells, but take off the veil. It's like cells. We put ourselves in these little prisons sometimes. We feel good in there for a while, but we don't really have any freedom. Because eventually we'll have to stop that being in the soccer crowd, or being in the footy crowd, or being in the marriage, or being with other people, or being in the crowd, being in our group. We can't stay in that forever. And when we are out of that little, what is it called, identification matrix, then we feel lost. We don't know who we are, what we mean. It is an identity crisis. So often when we actually think of actually who we think we are, so often we define ourselves by our family, by our marriage, by our job, by our physical relationships in the world. Which I think is one of the reasons why when people go through divorce, it's not just like losing a loved one, it's losing an identity, which causes a great deal of angst and suffering. When you're by yourself, it's not just, you know, not knowing what to do. It's just not knowing who you are is one of the problems. And this is actually where Buddhism, of probably all religions and paths, can really come to the rescue. Because the rescue comes from this incredibly powerful and deep teaching of the Buddha called non-self. In our world, we're always encouraged to make identities. I am the monk. But when I was in Stoke-on-Trent, I wasn't the monk, I was the clown. And I was just had an invitation today from Singapore just a few minutes ago that they wanted to do a... Because apparently in Singapore there is a controversy. The governor of Singapore wants to open up a casino. And the different religions are actually... Some are fighting it, some are, you know, questioning it, some are supporting it. I don't know what's happening over there. But they said they wanted actually to get me to go over there. During the Range Retreat, I had to refuse. And they wanted actually to me not to give a talk, but take part in a play, in a skit, in a comedy routine. And that was actually quite attractive to me, to this. If it wasn't during the Range Retreat, I would have said, yeah. Because that way, I wouldn't be a monk. I'd be like the comedian, like the actor. And that's, I don't know, as a monk these days, sometimes you like just actually changing your roles and being something different. What was it that time that it was a very funny funny occasion when many years ago, when I was not the abbot and not so fat, I used to be like very active on the building sites of our monastery. I was the main builder of my monastery, but you know, I've learned how to delegate, and now all the other monks do it. It's really great. But I remember on this one occasion, I'd been working, and when you're actually working, you know, you wear your robes or your underrobes. And if you actually build it, you get very dirty. You just can't help it. When you're mixing concrete or you're laying bricks or you're shoveling dirt, you're going to get dirt over you. So we just finished the morning work. We'd been laying some concrete or making some cement or something. So I was all covered with, you know, the grey splodges of cement all over myself. And I was actually walking back to the our dining hall, you know, for the lunch. And it was actually a Sri Lankan lady who had come to visit. And like many people who come to our monastery, you know, they're very well dressed. You know, it's a monastery, it's a place of religion. And you've got like, not your Sunday best, but I think it was her Tuesday best she was wearing. And so, you know, she came up to me, and it was the first time. They said, "No, we come to bring some food for the monks." She said, "Now, where should we go?" And I said, "Well, look, if you go up into that dining room over there, you wait up there, the abbot will be round in a few minutes." I never told him I was the abbot. And I rushed to my hut, had a very quick shower. It's amazing how quick you can have a shower when you're mindful. 5 minutes, dry myself up, put on some clean robes, and went to go and see her and had a nice little chat with her before she offered the food. But afterwards, you know, she said, "Oh, it's really inspiring, really good monastery here, but if you don't mind me saying something, you should tell some of your monks to dress properly, because I just came across that monk before I came in." And he was a mess. He was sloppy, and that's not right for Buddhists. I said, I'll tell him, madam. But it was me. And I don't mind just being just the sloppy, dirty labourer. Or sometimes, you know, the abbot. Sometimes a wise teacher, or just sometimes a person doing a comedy routine. The other thing which I always remember, again, a Sri Lankan man in Melbourne, after one of my talks, it's one of my prized moments I'd always remember. You know, there's some occasions happen to you in your life which, you know, just imprint itself on the mind, some of the happy moments. You know, that if I wrote my biography, this would be one of them. When he came up after my talk and he said, "I've really come to compliment you, not so much on the Dhamma, but your comedy and your timing. Where do you get your material from?" he said. And then he announced himself. He was actually a comedian on the television in the Melbourne Comedy Club, a Sri Lankan boy. Maybe you may know him, I don't know these people. But anyway, he offered me a job. He offered me a job in the Melbourne Comedy Club. I thought for a little while, shall I not? I said, no, I don't think the Buddhist Society of West Australia will let me go to Melbourne. But anyway, sort of, now, what role are you? Are you the serious monk? Or are you the comedian? Are you the worker? Are you the meditator who's just on his own, hours after hours? Are you the person who can sit up and give a talk to thousands of people? Or go up in front of the television? Are you the Buddhist? Or are you the Catholic who hangs out with the Catholic priests? Who are you? Now this is a wonderful thing with Buddhism. The Buddha said, look, you don't have to be any of those things. You can let go of this identification with being a woman, with being a man, with being American, with being old, with being sick. The Buddha actually said this wonderful saying that even though your body is sick, your mind does not need to be sick. It's a beautiful saying because you can, you know, talk for hours just on that one saying. Even though your body is sick, your mind doesn't need to be sick. You don't need to identify with that sickness. Yeah, my body's sick, my body's dying, my body's got cancer, but not my mind. I don't have to identify. I am not that sick body. That's a powerful thing to do. If you can do that, it's amazing. Just sickness and pain can be there, but you can be laughing and telling jokes at the same time. It can be done. It has been done. To show my ecumenical spirit, one of my favorite people, St. Lawrence. The reason why he's one of my favorite people, because when he was being burnt on the stake, I think he was actually burnt on sort of this iron grid or something. It's like being barbecued, literally. You know, because, you know, I'm very fortunate these days because I say some sort of controversial things, but we don't have such punishments anymore. Otherwise, I'm sure that would happen to me. But he was actually said something really radical, a joke which nobody got or something, and he was being given the final punishment. But the great thing about this fellow is a Catholic, a monk, St. Lawrence, was his final words. Now, you've all probably experienced like the pain of being burnt. Just your fingers. You may have sort of burnt your fingers. I was told actually the pain of burning is actually one of the worst possible pains a human being experiences. You know, burn pains are terribly painful. And here was a man being burnt alive. Charred. Burning raw, and his last words were, "Turn me over, this side's done." He cracked a joke. And I thought, wow, I wish I could do that. You see that he was really in great pain, but he could actually transcend that and say, no, that's the world. I don't need to relate to it in that way. I can't do anything about it. And I always like the compassion. Because he probably saw all those people watching him being burnt alive. It's not a pleasant thing. They're probably all miserable. He decided to cheer them up. Not thinking of himself or even of his body, but transcending it. That can be done. It has been done. You can do it as well. So if we can actually do that, surely we can actually transcend loneliness. And how we do it is say, it's not me who's lonely. It's just there's no one there, that's all. But I am never lonely. The reason is, there's always somebody there. And who's that? You are always here. How could you be lonely when you are your best friend? Or is it because you are your worst enemy? Now this is again where we get into some very deep ideas of what loneliness is all about. Sometimes people hide from themselves in their relationships with others. Sometimes people hide from themselves by going and running around and doing things and making themselves busy. What are they doing all this for? Sometimes I really wonder. People work so hard. Why do you work so hard? To get a bigger house, that's why. Many people, they got a nice house. They think, well, you can retire now, put a bit of money aside. You can retire. I said, no, I've got to get a bigger house. Investment, they say. Well, they get another house, a second house, another one to worry about. Investment, they say. How big a house do you need? You know the answer to that question? A house which is made of wood, 6 foot long, 2 foot wide, maybe 1 foot high. That's the house you're going to end up in. Or your children will get the rest, or Mr. Costello. So why are you working so hard for Mr. Costello for? But the thing is that the reason why people work so hard, a lot of time is because they're running away. They don't know how to be still. They don't know how to be peaceful. What are they running away from? They're running away from themselves a lot of the time. Sometimes people say, you monks, you're just into escape. You're escaping from the real world. I say, no. We're actually facing the real world. We're facing ourselves. Many people who go on retreats or come and stay in a place like our monastery just for a few days. Wow. There's nothing to do. So can we do some charging in the morning? No. Can we do some work, do some sweeping? No. Can I do something? No. Stay in your room and do nothing. And it drives them crazy. Why? Because they have to actually stop and face themselves and find out who they are. And once they stop and face themselves, after a while, they find you're not as bad as you thought you were. And after a while, when you find you're not as bad as you thought you were, you can actually get to like yourself and be at peace with yourself. And even your crazy mind. Oh, that's okay. It's not the crazy mind. It's how you relate to it. Tell all those meditators, if your mind's going all over the place, welcome it. It's nature. Let it be. Be friends with yourself. And then it becomes still. But if you start to be a control freak, you get into all the suffering of life. The controlling is the wrong relationship with what you're experiencing. So if you're by yourself, stop running away from being by yourself. Face it. It's like the old story of when you run away from ghosts, the ghosts have power over you. But if you stop, turn around and face the ghost, then you've got power over the ghost. It's the ghost then starts running away. I've told that story before, but in the early life as a monk, when I used to go and scare the ghosts in our monastery in in Thailand, I already told that story, so I don't mind telling it again. When just, because our monastery in Thailand is full of ghosts, absolutely chock-a-block. Could have been burning bodies there for years and years and years and years, and they hang out there. So when I went round to go and see them, and I went to go and say hello, literally, and they went, ah, you can see. I said, yeah, sure. Ah, they started running away. They show me that. I said, ghosts, no. If they think they got power, you can't see them. Of course, they've got little power over you. You can mess around, but if you can see them, they get afraid. You've got more power than they have. So when you actually face the ghost, this is almost like a metaphor as well. If you face your fear of fear or loneliness, you face it instead of running away from it. Hey, what is this? And actually, you find it's not such a big deal. Then loneliness will be afraid of you. When loneliness is afraid of you, it's not loneliness anymore. It's this beauty of being by oneself. It's like a oneness. Lonely. You take the Y off the end. You take the L, the hell out of it. Two hells, one at the beginning, one at the end. And you've got this beautiful oneness in the middle. So lonely becomes like oneness. And isn't that the goal of so many religious paths, to come to oneness, the unity, the non-duality of existence? And there you can have it, in the beautiful silence and oneness of this moment. Well, it's not two people anymore. It's not 10, it's not 100, it's not 1,000. Just this beautiful oneness. There you get a unity. Isn't that spiritually uplifting? Which is why we have the whole tradition of hermits in spiritual life. We've also had the tradition of communities as well. When I was talking with the Benedictine monks, I was saying basically our monastery is a community of hermits. We come together for a short time, you know, to have our dana, you know, when we eat together. But afterwards, you know, everyone splits as soon as they can. You can see even monks, they just get the food in the bowl and they're off. Spend the rest of the time by themselves. Even like Ajahn Chitamalo. Now, he's been on retreat for a couple of weeks, haven't seen him. I did see him just in brief when he came to one of the talks. Perhaps, don't know what he's up to. He's disappeared for all this time. It's great. This is what monks do. They just vanish. They disappear into the great void of our monastery. I think, what do they do that for? Because in that disappearance, you go even further than just being at one. Remember lonely, you take the why off the end, no questions, take the hell out of it on both ends, and you get one. And the next stage is to add the N in front. None. This is actually the path. The path of religion. Sometimes you notice that they say in ancient times it was like polytheism, like many, many gods. And then we move to the one single God. The oneness of things. And then Buddhism went further and went to the nonness of things. Which I thought is a great. You can't go further than nothing. That's the infinite. That's the end. And this is what happens when you're sort of by yourself. First of all, there's you there. But to overcome that loneliness deeply, you disappear. And when you can disappear in that oneness, it's not lonely anymore. There's nothing left. And how does that oneness disappear? It's because we have this ego, us, me, the one in charge. And it's just a relationship problem, because when we control things, we manipulate things, we grab things, we want things, that strengthens this one of us. And that's a danger. Because the stronger that one is, it's not just the relationship which we have to have more relationships the more we think we're here. But it also means the further we are away from just disappearing, from melting, from going into the great void, where there is no oneness, nor manyness. So it doesn't make any difference when you're in front of a crowd of 1,000, or you're just by yourself, when you know there's no one there anyway. How many people am I giving this talk to today? No one. There's no one here. Hands up if you're here. See, no one put their hand up. So, when one understands about how to let go of this idea of a self, when you let go of the idea of a self and just disappear, you also let go of all this controlling and all this manipulating and this fighting. And of course, that's where the loneliness disappears. You're letting go. You're merging into the moment. You're allowing this moment to be. And when there's no fighting it, when there's no conflict, there is an emerging into oneness. And from that oneness, into nonness. And that is the end of loneliness. And it's also the end of togetherness. It's when there's no space between you and what you're experiencing. There's no other. There's no here left anymore. So this is why somebody asked in this question they wrote to me, does meditation help? Of course it helps. Because when we're meditating, we're learning how to let go. To stop controlling. To appreciating things as they are. In the beginning of this evening, I told you how to meditate. It doesn't matter if the dogs are whining because policeman has his sirens. It doesn't matter if some kids are whispering. It doesn't matter if people are coming in on the back. It doesn't matter if someone's farting or whatever they're doing. It's how you're relating to it. That's the problem. And if you're relating to it in a peaceful way, accepting the door of my nose is open to that smell. It's open anyway, you can't close it. So whatever it is, if you open your heart to it, you see it's at peace in. There's no problem. And have you ever noticed, this is actually something people notice in meditation, the more they let go, the more peaceful they get, the more they feel they're dying. People have actually said that sometimes they're meditating, they say, I can't go any further, it's like I'm dying. I say, great, this is what we're doing. We're here to the self, the me, which causes the loneliness, which causes the having to have somebody around, which causes the controlling. That's disappearing. You are dying. But in its place, you're getting to this beautiful oneness and then noneness. What's dying deserves to die. That which separates you from the world. That which blocks you off from being part of things. This terrible self business. Me. I'm a Sri Lankan. I'm a doctor. I'm a monk. I'm a man. I'm a woman. I'm old. I've got cancer. I'm a kid. No, you're not. When you can let all of that go, imagine what freedom you have. Yeah, the body's got cancer, but not me. Yeah, my body might be ugly, but not me. My body might be old, but not me. And that way, there may be nobody around. That's bodies, but not me. And that way, all loneliness starts to evaporate and disappear. Not only loneliness, but togetherness. Too often that people think they have to have relationships in this world. And so they go around to all these lonely hearts clubs. Yes. You know, some people even come here to this temple looking for partners in life. They do. But this is not the be-all and end-all of life. It's not the relationship with another person. It's not being alone is not the problem. It's how we relate to these things. And if we relate to them in a wise way, in this beautiful meditative way, we let go, we learn. We can relate to anything in meditation. That's why people can have a great pain in their body. They just relate to it in a beautiful way and it's just there. It's just so peaceful. They have this great noise. Many years ago, it's been a long time since I did this, that we had this, it was like a demonstration come sort of something about the political situation in Burma many years ago. I think it was just when Aung San Suu Kyi first got arrested. And some of the Burmese Buddhist community, we had this little demonstration outside the Uniting Church opposite Hay Street Mall. I think it must have been Barrack Street. Is it Barrack Street? But it's just opposite anyway. And so when it got there, the demonstration was just meditating. So we're meditating there for 2 hours on the pavement in all the noise of the Hay Street Mall with this video, no, it's a game shop or some, what they had those, time, was it time zone or something? Opposite, with all this noise blaring out. Now if you think those dogs were a problem, imagine meditating opposite time zone. And it's wide a wonderful meditation. It said, this is going to test me out. Sort of, can you meditate in such a noisy place? And of course, how do you do that? You stop fighting. You don't stop thinking, oh, I wish they'd shut down this noise. Now, can't we complain to the council about this noise? Or can't someone get me some earmuffs or some earplugs or something? That's not the way you get peace in Hay Street Mall. The only way is to leave it alone. Let it be. It's how you relate to the noise, that's the problem. Or as Ajahn Chah famously said, and again you could have another 2 or 3 talks on just this saying, when we complained about the noisy villagers, because every now and again they would have a party. And when they had a party, it was a big one. Really noisy. They got the most modern amplifiers and turned them up to max. So even you're supposed to be in a forest monastery, in these little huts, you could hear the noise as if it was right inside your room with a ghetto blaster. And so, of course, there's no way those villagers would listen to us. But with our teacher, Ajahn Chah, surely they'd listen to him. So we went to complain to Ajahn Chah. He said, look, they won't listen to us. And they've been doing this not just, you know, once every couple of months. It's become popular once every couple of weeks now. Can you please tell these villagers to turn it down? The noise is disturbing us. And the great master Ajahn Chah, just one sentence just makes us the whole difference in your whole of your life. He said, it's not the noise disturbing you. You are disturbing the noise. Understand? It's not the loneliness disturbing you. You are disturbing the loneliness. That is the problem. It's not the cancer disturbing you. You are disturbing the cancer. Wow. When you understand that, you understand how you can be free. You can't control the villagers. You can't control this body with its illnesses. You can't control your life, thinking I can have some people around all the time and sometimes I can get rid of them. I've given up trying to control people a long time ago. I can't even control my monks. They know that. So when you stop controlling things, you're not disturbing life. Therefore, life doesn't disturb you. There, you find freedom. So, the problem of loneliness is solved right there. The same way we solve the problems in meditation. We're sitting there, we don't disturb this moment. When we don't disturb this moment in meditation, we leave it alone. It's incredible just how still, how peaceful, how blissful you get. Incredibly blissful. More power, more bliss than you could ever imagine. Spiritual power. It becomes a lesson for you, an object lesson, into how to find freedom, to peace and harmony. When you know how to do that in meditation, you apply that to all these other things in life. You're by yourself, I'm not going to disturb it. And then being by yourself is just so beautiful, so powerful, so meaningful. When you're with other people, you don't disturb it. And being with others becomes so powerful, so meaningful, so incredibly beautiful. Now you know how to escape from loneliness, from being with others. It's a relationship you have with it. That is the problem, and that is the solution. So there you go, a talk tonight on loneliness and all other problems of life. In fact, I've taught you the secrets of Buddhism in everything, so you don't need to come back next week at all. Well, I guess you will.